So we're here in chapter 19 and verse 21. And it says, after these things were ended, Paul purposed in the Spirit, when he passed through Macedonia and Achaia, to go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. Now, there's probably two reasons for him wanting to go to Jerusalem. Number one, he needs to deliver the gift money which the Gentile churches had collected. This is shown in Romans chapter 15, verses 25 and following. The Gentile churches had collected money for the church in Jerusalem. And Paul probably felt it as his responsibility to deliver that money. So that's one of two reasons. And the second is his great love for his Jewish brethren. He wants another opportunity to minister to them. He just can't accept their no as the final answer, as their final response. And he's going to find out, though, that it is their final response, and I think he ends up finding it out the hard way. But these are the two main things that are probably involved here as to why he wants to go to Jerusalem. And he's probably using the thing about the money more as his excuse to go there. The main thing is his love for his brethren. You can also note 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and following, and 2 Corinthians 8, verses 1 and following. Verse 22, so he sent into Macedonia two of them that ministered unto him, Timotheus and Erastus, but he himself stayed in Asia for a season. So he may have sent them there to collect further this offering. That may be why he sent them there. And this is the first time Timothy has been mentioned since chapter 18 and verse 5. So he's not mentioned too many times. First time since chapter 18, verse 5. Erastus may be the same Erastus of Romans 16, verse 23. Romans 16, verse 23. Other than that, we really don't know anything about him. Verse 23, and the same time there arose no small stir about that way. Now, from this verse through the end of the chapter, we find that before Paul finally leaves Ephesus, he meets with an attack of violent opposition led by Demetrius, a silversmith. And Demetrius is mentioned in the next verse, and he built silver shrines for Diana. He was in the Madonna building business, just that instead of it being Mary, Mother of God, it's Diana, the fertility goddess, and it brought no small gain unto the craftsmen. Demetrius probably is a very wealthy and influential person, and he's holding a position over these other craftsmen. He's probably like the head over their trade union. It's probably like a trade union, and he's probably the head over it. And they built these small temples with the image of Diana in the temple. Just a small little temple made out of silver, and it was probably very lucrative. I'm sure they cost quite a bit, and just can't have a home without one. What makes your home complete is to have your little temple to Diana. And so he's making a lot of money from this. And this is what his motivation is. His motivation is not for the well-being of the city. And he's just so concerned that our wonderful goddess is being spoken of in a bad way, and mean old Paul is hurting us, and This is just terrible what he's doing to our community. It's the old pocketbook is the motivation. That's exactly what it is. It's the love of money. He was wealthy. That's what you see in verse 25. Middle of verse 25. Sirs, ye know that by this craft we have our wealth. The Greek is prosperity. This is what makes us prosperous. And Paul is turning people away. And he's saying that they be no gods which are made with hands. That should be obvious. Shouldn't it be obvious to everybody? Anything that man can make with his hands, how can that be a god? What a puny god. Such a puny little god. It cannot be, but in their deceived minds, they can't see that. Verse 27, so that not only this our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised and her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all age in the world worship. Oh, sad, tragic. To say the least, it's one big fat lie. He could care less. He wants money. His motivation is greed. He's losing money. He won't be able to pay for his summer home, his winter home, and his vacations across the Mediterranean and all the rest. That's what his concern is. I don't mean to misread his motives and, you know, judge him and accuse him, but I just kind of suspect that I'm probably hitting the nail on the head here. I just kind of feel that way. I just kind of feel like that's I'm given a right view as to what this man's heart was. Verse 28, and when they heard these sayings, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, great is Diana of the Ephesians. So he gets them stirred up and makes for a real interesting time here. And the whole city was filled with confusion. And this is what their anger produced. It produces irrational behavior. Notice verse 32. They all come together, and it says the assembly was confused, and the more part knew not wherefore they were come together. They don't even know why they're there. They don't know what's going on. Just a big gathering, and time to let off some steam, I guess. Now it says, and having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel, they rushed with one accord into the theater. Now, we don't know anything really about Gaius. It's a very common name in the New Testament. Aristarchus, you can note chapter 20, verse 4, chapter 27, verse 2, 24, 27, 2, also Colossians 4, verse 10. Now, this theater has been excavated, and it's a large open-air theater holding about 25,000 people. So that's fairly large. It's a little bit less than about half the kingdom. The kingdom holds about 65,000, so a little bit less than half. But that's a good-sized open-air theater, and it's standing room only as they get together for a little afternoon recreation here. They're trying to get Paul to come in their midst so they can have a little let him know their feelings. They don't appreciate what Paul's doing. Verse 31, though, and certain of the chief of Asia, which were his friends, is talking about Paul. See, Paul would have gone in. That's what verse 30 says. And they desired him that he would not adventure himself into the theater. Well, that'd be quite an adventure, all right. Certain of the chief of Asia, the Greek is Asiarchs. That's what the Greek word is. A-S-I-A-R-C-H-S. That whole phrase, certain of the chiefs of Asia, the Greek is Asiarchs, A-S-I-A-R-C-H-S. It seems to mean chief provincial officials whose duties were partly religious as well as partly civil. And they just don't feel like it's time for Paul to go into the lion's den. And Paul wanted to go in to offer a defense. See, Paul is not living under fear. Paul is trusting God. But I think there are some times that Paul, in his boldness and in his faith, he needed some other people to kind of temper that. There are some people, you don't have to stir up faith in them. You have to kind of quench it. There are people, they will step into virtually any situation with no fear. There are saints of God like that. Maybe not too many, but there are some. They need some advisors along with them sometimes that are exercising a little bit more discretion. Paul seems to be one who, if a need arises, he'll be the first one there. And he'll step in trusting God. He's a man of faith. Tremendous example of faith. Not necessarily in every case an example of wisdom, but it's hard to evaluate exactly. And so in this case, he says, well, okay, I'll do what you tell me to do, and I won't go in there. So he gives some thought to their statements, and he does not venture into this theater. And I think that was the wise thing to do. When we see there in verse 32 that the more part knew not wherefore they were come together, this is the norm. The majority of people do not have the slightest idea of what they are doing at any time on planet Earth. They don't. They do not know what they're doing. They don't have the slightest idea what they're doing. There are people every day by the hundreds that lose their lives because they are just abysmally ignorant. They don't know what they're doing. People risk their lives all the time because other people are doing certain things. They don't even think. They don't realize what they're doing with life. This is shown in the book of Jeremiah. It's a very similar kind of account. Jeremiah chapter 26, verses 7, 8, 11, 12, and 16. 7, 8, 11, 12, and 16. And when you take time to read this, which I hope you will do, notice what all the people do. The phrase, all the people. You're going to see that all the people are fickled. That's the way the people are. They'll be on this side, but as soon as it's to their advantage to be on this side, they'll switch sides without a second thought. That's the way people are. You can't count on the masses for anything. The masses don't know up from down, especially when they're brainwashed by the boob tube all the time. They don't know what's going on. The average person out here doesn't have the slightest idea what's involved in life. He does not understand government. He doesn't understand economics. He doesn't understand religion. He doesn't understand anything except he wants a roof over his head and food in his tummy. And I'm not trying to discredit people. It's just the way that it is, though. They don't think. How many people think out in life? How many thinkers do you meet? You're really giving thought to life. Can't even count them on one hand. Sometimes you don't even need one finger. You don't find many people that give a lot of thought to life, do you? How many people really give a lot of thought to life? People that give thought to life, sometimes they're the ones who commit suicide. Because they can see there's no purpose in it. That's sometimes the people who commit suicide. And others, praise the Lord, get saved. But it wasn't because we gave so much thought to life that we got saved, necessarily. Some of us just got saved. We don't even know how it happened. We don't know how we got community chapel or anything else, but praise the Lord we got here. And but life is filled with this kind of person, and they're not educated. I just read a little bit of an article in the paper talking about the in the high schools and colleges, there's hardly any teaching, very small percentage really, only... I don't remember the figures, but the point was only a small teaching on the history of our nation. So hardly anybody really knows the culture. They don't know where this nation really came from. See, now who has done that? See, if you can take the heritage away from a people, then they have nothing to live for as far as that nation is concerned. That's the devil. He's done that. That's why people, for the most part, really aren't patriotic. They're not. Now, patriotism has had a little bit of an upswing over the last couple of years, which I'm glad to report, mainly because of President Reagan, but still, put somebody else in the White House of a different view, different slant, and it can be drained right away again. A nation that will just give away the Panama Canal can't have its head screwed on straight. A nation that thinks that Russia is reliable and will be trustworthy can't know much about anything in life. And a nation who thinks that the government can keep paying the bill so that we can all have food and all have these social needs met, they also can't be a thinking people. They can't be a thinking people. And people who go along with all the civil rights can't be a thinking people. And the people who voted down this thing on abortion, and so that we still have to keep paying for it, can't be a thinking people. They can't be a thinking people. They're not thinking. And then when you put them as jurors in a jury court system, wow. Hope I'm never in that position, and my sentence depends on their brains. That is a dangerous world out there. That's a dangerous place. People aren't giving much thought to these things, though. And if they do, they just panic. And they immediately say, well, what can we do about it? So they put their head back in the sand, just like the ostrich. And it's just about the way life is. Terrible situation. We've got to do a lot better than that as saints of God. We've got to do a lot better. We've got to really think about where we're going, what we're doing, why we're here. Let's look at the purpose of these things. We've got to give a lot of thought to this. We've got to meditate on these things. Now, verses 33 and 34... they drew Alexander out of the multitude of the Jews, putting him forward, and Alexander beckoned. See, the Jews knew that this could cause some problems with them as well. Because Paul and some of these others that are preaching Christianity, they're Jews. So they're going to make a connection between Christians that are Jews with other Jews or non-Christians, but because they're both Jews, that can be problems for them, even though they're not Christians. So they want Alexander to go out here and make a defense. But when they all knew that he was a Jew, all with one voice, about the space of 2 hours, cried, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Now that is an idiotic. What is the purpose of this? 2 hours saying this one thing? That's ridiculous. Bruce says in his commentary on Acts, "The resentment against those who paid no honor to the great goddess was as much anti-Jewish." So that's part of the problem as well. The Jews aren't worshiping Diana either. So those who paid no honor to the great goddess was as much anti-Jewish as anti-Christian. And this alarmed the Jews of Ephesus. They judged it necessary to disassociate themselves openly from Paul and the other missionaries and put up Alexander, one of their number, to make it plain to the mob that the Jewish colony had nothing to do with the present trouble. But when Alexander got up to speak, the people paid no attention to what he wished to say. All that they cared for was that he was a Jew, and therefore no worshiper of Diana. Some of them may even have thought he was the cause of the trouble, seeing that he appeared so eager to make a speech for the defense. And remember, the majority of people don't know what's going on. So they don't even know why they're there. So how they're going to evaluate what Alexander's going to do, they can't possibly make an accurate evaluation. So for them to think that he's the root of the problem, that would be a pretty normal assumption. When he beckoned for silence and attention, therefore, they shouted him down for the next 2 hours and kept up their cry, "Great Diana of the Ephesians." Now, verse 35, "And when the town clerk had appeased the people," the town clerk, he is really the most influential person of the city. He's like the mayor. He keeps the archives of the city, that is the city records. He was like the treasurer of the city, presided over their assemblies, their council sessions. And the reason he gets involved in this is because he's directly responsible to Rome. And if Rome finds out about a riotous town assembly like this, they're in trouble. Notice verse 40. "For we are in danger to be called in question for this day's uproar, there being no cause whereby we may give an account of this concourse." See, he knows there is no way that we can explain this to Rome. They will say that was totally out of place. That was a riot, and there was no reason for it. And he knows that. And they can't say, "Well, Paul." And then this was said. That will not appease Rome. Rome will be very upset. Rome doesn't want riots. They want their whole empire to just run nice and smooth. No news is good news. Bad news is really bad news. Riots, that's bad news. He understands this. I think Rome had a way of making this real clear to people like this, with actions like, you know, that's the way they end the conversation. Now just remember, and he goes, okay, he goes back, he's going to make sure everything goes real smooth. You got 25,000 people that are yelling like this for 2 hours. That means the town clerk has lost control. It means Rome's going to be upset if they hear about this. Now he mentions this image. He says, "Ye men of Ephesus, what man is there that knoweth not how that the city of the Ephesians is a worshiper of the great goddess Diana and of the image which fell down from Jupiter?" Now, we don't know what this is really talking about as far as this image. It may speak of some sort of a meteor which fell to earth, and they then said that was from Zeus, that is from Jupiter. And it may have become then a sacred object, and they may have even said this is the representation of Diana. This has come from the gods, and so that may be what it's talking about. It's very ambiguous. There's no detailed information given on it, so all we can do is make just a basic assumption here. But I think he's appealing to something that happened historically that was a supposed verification that there is this great goddess, and what we worship is really true. And, so even though these men are saying this about Diana, how can they really take away from our great goddess? See, for us to panic over what these people are saying, he's trying to show them it's foolish. We have these experiences. This happened. Jupiter sent this image down to us. We have this historical verification. So what these people are saying now, that can't change what we know to be true. That's the kind of argument that he's presenting here. His reasoning is, how can anyone overturn this? How can anyone really take away our worship of Diana? He says in verse 36, "Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, you ought to be quiet and to do nothing rashly." He's telling them not to panic. We've got our experiences. We have our verification. "For ye have brought hither these men, which are neither robbers of churches, nor yet blasphemers of your goddess." Churches should be translated temples. "And they brought Gaius and Aristarchus," and he's pointing out, now really, they haven't done anything wrong. As far as valid charges that Rome would accept as valid, there are none. The town clerk understands this. He understands Rome's view. Now, Rome's view will be they have broken no law, and any so-called blasphemy against Diana, that doesn't amount to anything as far as Rome is concerned. And this is what his point is. And I think it probably also involves the fact that as far as all sorts of direct statements against Diana, I don't think Gaius and Aristarchus were doing that. This was not, you don't just walk into this city that is focused completely on this kind of worship and just blast the worship. That is not what they did. They came in and they preached the gospel to the Jews. That's what they did. And then others got saved. And then because of this thing with the seven sons of Sceva, they started to realize their magic practices, their occultism, spiritism, and they were the ones who brought their books, and there's still nothing really directly said against Diana. There's no real attack made on her. That would be of no value. It was all much more done just by preaching the gospel and then by a moving of God's Spirit. And so there wasn't any accusations that could really be brought against Paul or Gaius or Aristarchus or anybody else for that matter. And he knew that. This town clerk understood it. It says in verse 38, "Wherefore, if Demetrius and the craftsmen which are with him have a matter against any man, the law is open. And there are deputies. Let them implead one another." Deputies are the proconsuls, that is, the various Roman governors. And when it says, "Let them implead them," it just means, go ahead and properly bring charges. See, now, if they've really done something wrong, then bring them to court. Bring them to court. Present the charges. The charge, well, we're not making as much money. That's not going to stand up in any court of law. Even a court there in Ephesus wouldn't work. The Roman governors Roman proconsuls wouldn't listen to that. And that's about all that Demetrius, isn't that what Demetrius was talking about? This is where we get our prosperity. We're not getting as much money. That's what his concern was. That's not breaking the law just because business goes bad. Verse 39, but if ye inquire anything concerning other matters, it should be determined in a lawful assembly. Just says, now, make sure if you're going to do anything, and if you're going to keep taking further steps, if your first legal step doesn't render the verdict you wanted, then the only thing that's available to you is to go to the next level. So that's what he's showing in verses 38 and 39. Take the first step. If you're not happy with that, then you can take a second step. You can make an appeal, but that's all you can do. He's saying follow all the legal steps, and rioting is not one of them. You don't have now do this, and then you can riot. Rioting is not one of the legal steps, especially when Rome is overseeing this whole thing. And so verse 40 shows his understanding that they have had a disorderly gathering. That's what he means by concourse, whereby we may give an account of this concourse, disorderly gathering. Ephesus was a free city, but improper action could remove this freedom. The town clerk could see the consequences of their outburst in Rome's eyes. And Rome also had the death penalty for riotous action. And they're not going to come in and kill all the people, but they'll kill the town clerk. And he knows that. So here's God using the laws, heathen laws, once again, to protect his sons. That shows how big God is. Here he can use the worship of Diana, the Roman government, all sorts of other things, and various laws that are all connected with it to protect his people. It's pretty amazing. Does the same thing with Jeremiah. And that account in Jeremiah 26 does the same thing. It's very interesting. So when he had spoken, he dismissed the assembly. They all went their way. And a lot of them probably asked one another, what was all that about? We were there yelling for 2 hours. Can you explain what really happened? And they all walked home in ignorance, didn't know what was going on. Chapter 20. And after the uproar was ceased, Paul called unto him the disciples and embraced them and departed to go into Macedonia. So now Paul leaves according to his original intent, chapter 19, verse 21. And on the way here, he was going to stop at Troas. We find this in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. So on the way, he'll stop in Troas. When he gets to Macedonia, Titus is going to rejoin Paul there, probably at Philippi. 2 Corinthians 7, verses 5 to 7. And the journey apparently extended as far as Illyricum. I'm sure it's not the way you pronounce that, but Illyricum. Illyricum. And this is a province on the Adriatic Sea in the northern part of Macedonia. And so evidently their journeys carried them to the northern part of Macedonia. Romans 15:19. So once again they're traveling. And it says in verse 2, and when he had gone over those parts and had given them much exhortation, he came into Greece. He now comes into Achaia. From Macedonia, he now comes south into Achaia, which is Greece. And he probably spent about 3 months here. And where he spends the time is probably in Corinth. And there abode 3 months, and that's probably in Corinth. And when the Jews laid wait for him as he was about to sail into Syria, he purposed to return through Macedonia. So there was a plot that forced him to travel more by land, which was not his original intent. And this would cause his journey to be much longer. and he would not be able to reach Jerusalem until Pentecost. And we'll see this in verse 16. I think he originally wanted to try to get there by the time of Passover, but because he's now forced to travel more by land to escape this plot against him, he's not going to get there until Pentecost. Verse 4, and there accompanied him into Asia, and it gives a list, seven men, Sopater of Berea, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus, and so on. And these were representatives of the churches from which Paul had gathered the offering for Palestine. And so he'd gathered money, as we mentioned, from the Gentile churches. And you can note here 1 Corinthians 16, verses 3 and 4. And these were representatives from these churches. And they probably wanted to travel with Paul to be able to visit the church in Jerusalem and to be able to give the money themselves personally. And it was just most likely it was a love offering. And they just wanted to give this to help the work there in Jerusalem to be able to prosper so they'd be able to do more with the gospel. It's probably the reasoning behind it. And it says, these going before tarried for us at Troas. Now, when it uses the pronoun us, it shows Luke once again joining the group. And this continues through chapter 21 and verse 25. So now Luke is seen here. And notice the we of verse 6 once again. And it just shows Luke is now involved in these travels. And we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread. Unleavened bread, that's Passover. And came unto them to Troas in 5 days, where we abode 7 days. So these had already traveled there, and we met them there. And they stayed there for about 7 days. Then he says, and upon the first day of the week, and that shouldn't say first day of the week, it literally says, and upon the one of the Sabbaths, on one of the Sabbath days. It doesn't say the first day of the week. This is put in here so that people begin to think of Sunday being somehow the Lord's Day, first day of the week, Sunday. It's not saying Sunday, it's talking about Saturday. And upon one of the Sabbaths, when the disciples came together to break bread. See, they wanted on the first day of the week, the church meeting on Sunday. They didn't meet on Sunday, they came together on a Sabbath day. It was a Saturday. They came together to break bread. And Paul preached unto them. Now, the breaking of bread here may be communion. There's no way to prove it. People try to use this verse to prove, here they are taking communion, and they take it on Sunday, and people use this to try to show, see, they're taking communion often, and people try to demonstrate their theology from verses like this, but their theology is something they've just come up with, and if they want to have communion morning, noon, and night, that's up to them. But that isn't what the scriptures support. Most likely, this was a combination of a fellowship meal and communion. That's most likely what it was. It's probably both, communion and a fellowship meal. But it doesn't really tell us. All it says they came together to do was to break bread, and Paul preached to them. And what breaking bread means exactly, we don't know. It's not defined for us. Now we know at the Last Supper, Jesus broke bread, so we can make that connection. But as far as it being absolute proof that they had communion, see, bread is one of their staples. They break bread at every meal. So just breaking bread means they're eating. That in and of itself doesn't prove that it's communion. You'll understand some of these things when you hear what other people say from these verses. And you'll understand some of the points better when you're confronted with these statements and how people just read their meanings, their views, their opinions right in, and then they use the verse as proof. A lot of circular reasoning, and it's not acceptable. Now, here they are. Paul's ministering to them. This is a story about Eutychus, and he keeps preaching and preaching, and Eutychus there in verse 9 says, being fallen into a deep sleep, and as Paul was long preaching, he sunk down with sleep and fell down from the third loft and was taken up dead. Eutychus means good fortune. Eutychus had good fortune. When it says from Being fallen into a deep sleep, Lenski gives the sense of the Greek, and it means gradually being borne down by sleep. It shows that he was fighting the sleep, but finally sleep got the best of Eutychus. And then when it says he sunk down with sleep, this shows that at this point the sleep has now completely overcome Eutychus. So he's fighting the sleep, but he's gradually being borne down by the sleep, and now he's actually in deep sleep. King James is not accurate. The idea there in the first statement is now he is already in deep sleep, and then it says he sunk down with sleep. That's confusing. The King James is confusing. He's gradually being borne down by sleep, and then he is completely overcome with sleep. And when he's fully overcome with the sleep, he falls from the third loft. There's nothing there to support him. And it says he's taken up dead. When they went to pick him up, he was dead. He was dead. He had fallen three stories, anywhere probably between 25 and 30 feet. And he's dead. And usually in something like this, he probably fell on his neck. And he was dead. This man was dead. And it wasn't that he just appeared to be dead or is unconscious. He was taken up dead. He died. Literally. And Paul went down and fell on him. I think Paul laid on him and embraces him. This is just like we find with Elijah and the widow's son, and also in the case of Elisha, when they spread themselves out on the person. And Paul, in effect, this is what he's doing. He goes right down and grabs him, probably lays on him or pulls him up close to him. And he's praying. You know he's praying. Don't you think he's praying? It doesn't say he's praying. And this is the kind of verse where the person who doesn't understand the Bible, these are the kind of examples you can give to somebody where you can read statements in the Bible and you automatically can read in a number of things that are absolutely acceptable. But if a person is just going to be tied to the letter and the ink on the page, they miss the whole thing that's being said. It's like when Paul's bitten by the viper and he just shakes it off. Just shakes it off? Didn't pray, huh? Well, it doesn't say he prayed. You know he prayed. What would happen if you had picked up some sticks, put them on a fire, and a big venomous snake grabs you and you shake it off? You're not going to pray, huh? No prayer. No prayer, huh? You're just not going to pray? Does it have to say that the person prays? You know what the person does. You know they pray. Paul prays here. It's just, these are the kind of things that you can use sometimes to get people to think accurately. Some people start to fancy themselves, I am a literalist. I believe the Bible. And so they fall in love with the ink, and they miss the whole sense of what he's saying, the whole purpose of what he's saying. We've got to get people to see this thing accurately. Trouble not yourselves, for his life is in him. God raises him from the dead. Now, overall, verse 12, well, he finishes preaching, and they broke bread and they ate, and they talked a long while, and he brought the young man alive, and were not a little comforted. So they end up being comforted by Paul's preaching, and also by Eutychus being raised from the dead. Eutychus was a very fortunate man. He became weary in well-doing, but God rescued him. Not everybody gets rescued. Very fortunate. You can compare with this 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 19 to 24. 1 Kings 17, 19 to 24. Also 2 Kings chapter 4, 32 to 37. This man was very fortunate. Eutychus had a good testimony of how God was able to deliver him from becoming weary in well-doing. And that's what it's showing spiritually. Verse 13, and he went before to ship and sailed unto Assos, there intending to take in Paul, for so had he appointed, minding himself to go afoot. And when he met with us at Assos, we took him in and came to Mytilene. Now, what it's showing is, in verse 13, that Paul's companions set sail for Assos, which is 20 miles south of Troas. They sailed while Paul went on foot. And then in verse 14, they meet together at Assos and now travel together. And I think that the main reason why he gives all of this historical information is to really demonstrate that this is a book emphasizing history, showing the various things that took place and how they traveled. And I think God is trying to give us a perspective on the kind of things that are involved in the ministry. There's a lot of traveling. And with all the traveling, they had to make all sorts of plans and schedule stops. There's just a lot more in the ministry than preparing sermons and preaching them. You know, it's kind of like people get the glamorous view of what is involved to be a movie star, some sort of a musician, athlete. They think the same thing of like a traveling evangelist, and they see the person in the ministry or in this occupation, and it can look glamorous, very appealing. That's because people don't see all that goes into it. They don't see the years of training, the preparation, whatever it is, whether it's a ministry, something that's spiritual, or something that is more mundane. It's true in every case. They don't see all the traveling. They don't see all the scheduling. They don't see all the work. They don't see all the effort. They don't see what the cost really is. People don't see that. And people can become very quickly disillusioned. I think Barak was quickly disillusioned. I think John Mark was disillusioned. I think Demas was disillusioned. I think Judas was disillusioned. And we also can be disillusioned. We have got to understand what the ministry really is. We've got to understand what the call of God really is. So I think he's giving us all of this to show us this was not just have Bible will travel, preaching all these sermons, souls saved, just all sorts of fantastic reports of the glory of God and tremendous miracles. That is not really what makes up the majority of the ministry. The majority of the ministry is not ministering. The majority of the ministry is traveling to the ministry, preparing for the ministry. It's a very rigorous thing. It's very demanding. And that's the way it is in life. And that's where we are on planet Earth, life. Life as it really is. And he's showing us that there was a lot that went into all these travels, all these different cities, all these different locations. And the traveling wasn't easy. Can you imagine the so-called first-class traveling accommodations? Donkey, camel, boat. What if you have a problem with seasickness? All sorts of things. How was the food? It wasn't fun. The ministry wasn't fun. He had to have a heart sold out to God, or else he would have done the same thing that John Mark did and others have done. They quit. They quit because it doesn't end up being as glamorous. When they're actually in the ministry, it loses its appeal. God doesn't want us to have a wrong view of this thing. He's not wanting us to get a view that causes us to live in dread and say, well, then forget it. But he wants us to realize that we need his spirit and his heart. We need his love. We need him moving in our lives, or else we're not going to do these things. We're not going to go out and minister in a Podunksville. I don't know what has kept people out there in the ministry. As far as, you know, if you look in the natural, there's nothing. What keeps them out there? There's a lot of Podunksvilles out there. Small churches. Small churches got problems. It's not that it's all just grand and glorious. They got demons, weaknesses, sins. They don't know up from down spiritually. And they're a person now that actually moved there. Now, I moved there with my family. There's no Christian school, no community chapel and Bible training center. I mean, they're it. They're the move of God. It's quite an amazing thing. And they go out there and they start to find out, this is a lot more than what I bargained for. They've got to start making some deeper commitments. They've got to start finding God. If you don't find God out there, you won't keep ministering. That's what keeps people out there. They find God. God becomes their strength. That's what kept Paul doing this. After all that Paul goes through, how can he still love the people? He still wants to preach to them. He'll still take any opportunity he gets. That's really a tremendous thing. He's looking for the opportunities. They're not just finding him. He's finding them. And then he's using them. So it tells more about their sailing there in verse 15. And then it says, for Paul had determined to sail by Ephesus because he would not spend the time in Asia, for he hasted, if it were possible, for him to be in Jerusalem the day of Pentecost. Now, the travel continues on, and where it brings him now is to Miletus, and that's about 25 miles south of Ephesus. And he knew if he went to Ephesus that he'd end up staying there, because he has too much of a heart for the people. I think that's what the problem is. He has such a love for the people there. He knows, now if I go into that city, I'm not going to be able to stay there a short time. I'm going to end up staying there weeks and months, and I feel like I need to get to Jerusalem. So that's why he sailed by the city, and when he was in Miletus, he sent to Ephesus and called the elders of the church. And he called for them to come down to him so that he could minister to them. And when they were come to him, he said unto them, ye know that from the first day that I came into Asia, unto after what manner I have been with you at all seasons. Now, when he says, I have been with you at all seasons, New American Standard translates that, I was with you the whole time. Kenneth Weiss translates it, how I was with you in close association for the entire time. Now, what he's saying, in my estimation, is he's making a point as to how dedicated and how committed he has been to them. He has really worked to help this church. He's always been concerned for them. And this is probably spoken to prepare their hearts for what he now has to say. And I think he's stating this in a bit of a hyperbole to show them that he's for them. He's never done anything to hurt them. He's not against them in any way whatsoever. And he's saying it this way because he has some other kind of hard things to bring. He has to give them some warnings. He says, serving the Lord with all humility of mind, with many tears and temptations which befell me by the lying in wait of the Jews. The connection in the statement here is, he served the Lord as God's slave with every humility and tears and trials. See, in every way, he's been serving the Lord. With humility, tears, and trials. And nothing has kept him from serving Jesus. He's continued to be humble. During the tears, that's the sorrows, the difficulties, as well as the joys. And then during trials, temptations, he's continued to serve God. And he's saying this so that they know how committed, dedicated, how much he loves them, how much he cares for them. And how I kept back nothing that was profitable, but have showed you and have taught you publicly from house to house. I did not shrink from declaring to you anything that was profitable. That's how Kenneth Weiss translates that. How I did not shrink from declaring to you anything that was profitable. I kept bringing all that you needed, testifying both to the Jews and also to the Greeks, repentance toward God and faith toward our Lord Jesus Christ. And now behold, I go bound in the Spirit unto Jerusalem, not knowing the things that shall befall me there. Now, bound in the Spirit, that phrase is very difficult. It seems to refer to Paul's own human spirit. He seems to be saying, in effect, there's something that has bound my own spirit, where I feel like this is what I have to do. I don't really think this was God's will. I don't think God really wanted him to go to Jerusalem. But it's what he's going to do, and God's going to honor it. I don't really think it's what God wanted him to do, though. He's warned by the Holy Spirit not to go in chapter 21, verse 4. But he wasn't able to receive that. I think in a broad manner of speaking, Paul is sinning. I think that, in effect, he's sinning. He's missing the mark. Not in a grievous way, but I think in a way that is similar to what Jonah did. Jonah wouldn't go to Nineveh. Why? Because of his great love for his people. He knew of God's grace and mercy and long-suffering, and he knew, because of the nature of God, there's such a good possibility that somehow you're going to be able to forgive those Ninevites, and that means my people one day are going to be in trouble. Because as long as they continue to exist, one day they're once again going to come down and attack us. That's what his sin was, the love of his people. Well, I think that's, in effect, what's happening here with Paul. His love for his brethren is overriding God's direction. He wants to minister to his people so badly. And he's going to get opportunities. God will back him up in this thing, and God will still get him to Rome. But I don't think he really followed the pathway that God intended. And I think he ended up going through a lot of things that were not really necessary. But that's kind of the way it is for all of us. And all we can really do is just present our opinions on the matter. We don't know absolutely. The scripture doesn't say absolutely that he errs, but I think it's a very good possibility. Now, he says in verse 28, "Take heed, therefore, unto yourselves and to all the flock, over which the Holy Ghost hath made you overseers to feed the church of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood." Now, this reading, "church of God purchased with his own blood," it's a very difficult phrase because it implies that God has blood. And we know that God doesn't have blood. The major manuscripts of Aleph and B, as well as the best texts, read Theos. They say the Church of God. So Aleph, B, Westcott and Hort, UBS, and Nestle's, they read Theos. There is another reading, which is Lord, Church of Kurios, purchased with his own blood, talking about it be easier to see Christ, who's Lord, Kurios, humanity. P74, manuscripts A and D. Usually, the most difficult reading is the correct reading. And I think the King James is correct. I think it does say Church of God. This shows Christ, who was God manifest in the flesh, shed his own blood. Christ, who is God manifest in the flesh, shed his own blood. It also shows, where he says Church of God, shed his own blood, it shows God intimately identifying with Christ on the cross. So in effect, God is saying, if I could have died, and if I had blood to shed, I would have for you, because of my great love. But since I can't die and I can't shed blood, I gave my son in lieu of that. You know, John 10, verses 14 to 18. John 10, 14 to 18. And so I think that's the way to view it. Let me finish this. He brings out next, verses 29 and 30, the very serious dangers. And the verses show that dangers will come from without as well as from within. And Paul's last statement here in verses 33 to 35 regarding this, where he says, "I have coveted no man's silver or gold or apparel. Yea, ye yourselves know that these hands have ministered unto my necessities, and to them that were with me I have showed you all things, how that so laboring ye ought to support the weak, and to remember the words of our Lord Jesus, how he said, it is more blessed to give than to receive." Paul is just saying that from his own life, they've been able to see that he's been free of self-interest, free of greed. So everything that he's saying is coming from God's heart with the intent to really help them, bless them, strengthen them. It's just like Jeremiah in Jeremiah 15:10. where he makes the point about usury, which is interest. And it was showing that he had done nothing to cause any man to be upset at him. He hadn't done anything where somebody would be stumbled. He had done everything out of a love and a motivation to help and to bless the people. Paul is saying this just so that they will really have ears to hear what he's saying. It's a very serious warning. There's going to be wolves. It's going to be those from the outside as well as those from the inside of the church. They're going to be raised up. They're going to attack. So if you're not on guard, if you don't really hear what I'm saying and understand what my heart is of concern for you, you're going to be hurt by this. So he's warning them, giving them a final warning. We'll start on chapter 21 next time.